Yeah. Here he goes again.
More picks, no plan.
You like the draft, we get it, man.
Same take, new frills.
A spreadsheet rebuild.
A spreadsheet rebuild.
And welcome in to a solo ride on the Big Red Bus. I'm Doug Tonis. We drive in the glorious monstrosity, as Fred likes to say, out onto the streets of the northwest suburbs where I live, and discussing the full offseason of the Chicago Bulls. Now, my focus is going to be on Bryson Graham's decision-making. I think before I get into that, I've called Bryson Graham a C-minus so far in his first offseason running the Chicago Bulls. But before we get into that, I just want to state very much up front that the most important thing that happened is the Bulls got the opportunity to draft Caleb Wilson, a player with very legitimate superstar upside. He had a very strong summer league. I think we're even more excited about him after seeing a summer league. He's got the amazing PR tour going. Everything he says, people are just jumping all over and in love to death. And that is super promising. And it's the most important thing by a million that happened this offseason. So while I'm walking through how I view Bryson Graham's offseason, I am not really giving him any credit or any blame for Caleb Wilson. If Caleb Wilson ends up being a terrible bust, I will not give Bryson Graham an ounce of blame for it. I just won't. And I don't think anyone else will either. This was a pick where you're going to take whichever of these top four guys dropped. Everyone was going to do that. And I think that's fine. I think that's fine. I will not give him any blame. Now, Caleb Wilson looks anything but a bust at the moment. Great summer league. Great start. Love everything about him so far. Tremendous upside. You just couldn't be any more excited about him. So that really is the lead. If you are just a normal Bulls fan, things are looking tremendously up because of that one thing. And I want to be super clear. The most important thing towards building a really good team is luck. And luck is a much bigger factor now than it ever has been because there is so much information parity. If you want to go back to the 90s or the 80s, you know, a lot of these NBA teams were not making money. If you go back to the 80s, you know, it was highly questionable whether this was a good investment at all, you know, to own an NBA team. Now that seems crazy because they have so much money. Everyone is just minting money now. Adam Silver and David Stern did an amazing job as commissioners and people growing the league into a financial powerhouse, and all the owners have benefited. But for a long time, that wasn't true. Teams didn't have really big management. They didn't have tons of scouts. They didn't have all of this stuff going on. And the decision-making was definitely not very symmetrical. Like, there were huge differences between what some teams would do and other teams would do. The amount of information was much, much less. It was much harder to gather information. The analytics were much different. I mean, now these teams all have access to services where you can just be like, show me every time player X was the ball handler in a pick and roll and got double team and went to the left and tried to split it. And you can just watch every single one of those video clips back to back. Like, so the scouting is just totally different. The analytics are totally different, and they have access to stuff that's way different than us. And so at a very high level, what that means is that with all of this information parity, decision-making in a lot of ways on players has never been more about luck. Like, which guy makes those unexpected leaps forward that you can't predict? And that is a huge part of it, is just taking a guy and saying, who is going to be better in 2 years than they look on paper today? And that ultimately is what often makes the difference. And I think there's just very little way to judge that. And I think if you look at history of these guys, you find that to be true. You don't find teams that are just consistently destroying it in the draft. It's part of why I've always been a big fan of the Thunder philosophy of just get tons of swings, just get tons of chances, get as many picks as you can, and then some of them are going to work, some of them aren't going to work, and you're going to just have a lot of optionality. Now, other teams have tried that and have not been successful. The Pelicans, one such team that has had a lot of picks and really hasn't been able to ever parlay that into something useful. The Utah Jazz, you have been in that boat. They still have a ton of future picks. Maybe they'll be successful with those going forward. Maybe not. We'll see. But they've certainly gone down that route. So it's not like that route is a given or an automatic. You know, the Thunder also got very lucky to get SGA, have a true superstar. So just that's a little bit about how the game has changed. And what really matters a lot is luck. And now I think the other thing that really matters is discipline. And I'm kind of like a game theory guy. I look at like a lot of these minor things. I have different rules that I go through and different ways that I see things. And I'm going to kind of walk through a lot of what happens and how disciplined the bulls are really being. So one of the things I pointed out about Arturis Karnišovas very, very early on was that he was very non-disciplined in his approach. Everyone always talks about being disciplined, but I don't think they really understand truly what that means. And you really find that very few decision makers, and I'm always going to use the term general manager as decision maker because that's historically what it was. And it's just easier. We all know Bryson Graham isn't the general manager. He's got like an SVP role or EVP role or whatever else you want to call it. I just use general manager as like decision maker because it's easier. So the general managers always say they're going to be very disciplined, but few people really are disciplined. So let's walk through all of the Bulls' moves and just kind of like talk them out from this perspective. So the first move they make is for Nick Claxton. And so from a discipline perspective, I find this to be a very poor move. So here's the thing. You've got like 50, 60 million in cap room. Now, there's not a lot of good players you want to go after, right? You maybe have already decided through your talks with other agents, you kind of know the money people are looking at, that you're not going to go after Walker Kessler. You're not going to go after Duren. You don't really want to spend big on any free agents. And you're just going to be patient, wait, save your money, whatever. Like you don't want to make a big splash. Like, you know, that's not something you're going to do. And so all these teams are talking beforehand. And so it's totally fair that you may already know that. But here's the thing. One really important approach to decision making is never make a decision before you have to. You only make a decision when something is going to be taken off the table, because you never know what new information or what new options will come up like later by simply waiting. And so they went really early on Nick Claxton. Now, the Nets obviously could not trade Claxton for value. They were looking to do that last year, and they couldn't. They obviously would have traded him for first-round pick or something else now if they could. There weren't like a bunch of other teams that were going to replace the Bulls in this trade, and this trade ultimately didn't have to happen when it happened. Like, there's no other follow-up that required that this move happen before the draft or before the start of free agency. So you went early, and this wasn't going to happen without you involved. There's no reason to go early. You could have just remained disciplined and waited and seen what would have happened. Now, the odds are probably nothing else was going to happen. But you had a lot of big moves. You have like Giannis out there on the trade market. You got Jaylen Brown out there on the trade market. You got the Warriors maybe looking to move Jimmy Butler so they can make room for LeBron and do some other moves. Like, who knows what you could have done with that massive cap room if you held on to it. Now, maybe nothing. But there were potentially like A-plus moves to be made. And you took those off the table so you could make this what I would call a C-minus move early. Because the Nets couldn't have traded Claxton earlier, like they tried, you already should know or think that you are not going to be able to trade him for more later. Like, by default, some people have argued with me, like, well, maybe we'll get more for Claxton later. By default, you should always assume you're going to get less than what you gave up for a guy if you trade him later. It doesn't always work out that way, but if you think about it, when you trade for someone, you are the high bidder. At that point in time, when you acquire that player, you are willing to pay more than anyone else. If you weren't, the team would have traded them to someone else where they got more. So you're the high bidder in that situation. And so if you're the high bidder now, what is likely to happen in a year? Like, who knows how that player's value will change in a year? But by default, you assume neutral, and no one is going to pay more than you. Again, it doesn't always work out that way, but the default is it's going to work out that way. It's going to work out that way more often than not. People have said maybe Claxton will get rehabilitated. I'm going to counter with, this is a guy who is getting epidurals in his back because he had back problems, playing center where he's like 40 pounds lighter than most of the guys he's defending. That doesn't seem like a scenario that is going to create long-term health for him and improve play. You've seen kind of like his numbers sort of decline over the last few years. Now, so why did they make this move? First, I think it's a few things. They also go down to poor process. One, they're solving the needs of yesterday. Look, you know you just are going to draft Caleb Wilson. You know he's going to be a shot blocker. You know you've got Matas Buzelis, who's a shot blocker. Those two guys are your two best players, so they're going to share the floor. They're going to play the three and the four. So maybe at one point, when you had Nikola Vucevic at center, you had this real problem with shot blocking. But now your starting center is Jalen Smith. Well, Smith, Mattis, and presumably Wilson probably are going to average about 5 blocks a game between the three of them. Like, so is shot blocking and rotational shot blocking still the problem it once was now that your front court is all guys who can chop block shots? And so Nick Claxton had the same shot block rate as Jalen Smith last year. So you're really getting a lot better there. Jalen Smith's a better rebounder. Jalen Smith's a better shooter. Jalen Smith is like a stronger, more physical player than Claxton, who's more of like a beam pole guy, which more replicates what you already have in Mattis and Wilson. So you got a guy who would have been a great fit if you had Zach LaVine and DeMar DeRozan here. That would have been fantastic. But you don't have those guys now. Like, this guy doesn't fit with the guys you have. Like, you need more shooting. We don't really have any reliable shooting on the starting lineup at this point in time anyway. And you need someone more physical who is going to handle a more physical matchup than you want to put on Wilson or Mattis. And, you know, Claxton just really isn't the guy to do any of those things. And so this fit is like also not super great. And so why did you make this move? One of the things we complained a lot about with the past front office, and really historically with the Bulls, is this insular thinking. Like, they're always thinking internally. Well, who's the Bulls' new head coach? Thiago Splitter. You know where Splitter was as an assistant? He was with the Brooklyn Nets. He was there right up through Nick Claxton's peak play in his career. And then he left, and then Claxton started to decline. Now, you could say one of two things happens here. One, maybe Thiago Splitter was a great coach for Claxton. And Splitter probably thinks this is true, and that he can get him back to where he was. And I think that's ignoring the reality that Claxton had significant injury problems, the types of problems that feel like they're probably going to still be there based on his play and what you saw visually of him in the future. He described the problem in 2024, or maybe it was 2024 in November, as something he's going to have to manage, you know, all year, and isn't going to get better. Now, he said in 2025, in the summer, going to training camp, everything is all good now. But his play deteriorated pretty significantly after that. So I think that's like highly questionable whether that's really true or not. Now, he has played in games. He's put down a ton of minutes. And for a Bulls team that's got Jalen Smith and Zach Collins on the roster as centers, that has its own value. Like, we've not had a center that's played a lot of minutes. But going forward, like, if I look at Jalen Smith's injuries, and I look at Zach Collins' injuries, and I look at Nick Claxton's injuries, the three of these guys, the types of problems they've had, Nick Claxton is the one who worries me the most about what's going to happen in the future. You know, like, the stuff that happened with Collins and Smith is like more like fluke things to me. And so I don't know that I would necessarily project Nick Claxton to be healthier than those other two guys. So we'll see what happens there. But that's just kind of my guess. Like, Zach Collins, outside of the major injury he had with his ankle early on in his career, he kind of like averaged, or I think it was around 60 games a year up until last year when he had a thumb injury. Like, so I just don't see that as something where I'm like, I don't trust Zach Collins to stay healthy compared to Nick Claxton. So we'll see how that goes out. But so those are the things to me that are just a little bit disturbing early. So it's kind of like you're following these needs you had in the past, but not necessarily the needs you in the present. You're overestimating the value because you're the only team willing to make this trade. The Nets couldn't get rid of him earlier, even though they were looking. You made the trade early, even though the whole thing would have had to wait on you because there's no one who's going to replace you and there's no need to make it early. Just wait for the draft to come and see if there's something better that happens in the draft. Wait for the first day of free agency to come to see if there's anything better for you there. It's just a C-minus move, and you just took other options off the table too early. And then, of course, the idea, we don't know for sure that this is true, but the idea that you made this move because Thiago Splitter is just using his own personal knowledge that's like 3 years old to evaluate Claxton rather than what has happened in the past 3 years. So those are things to me that are like kind of like disturbing patterns with this move. And I gave this move like a D or D plus. Now, for the record, for my rating scale, I do not use the master's degree rating scale where average is a B and no one gets a C unless you just completely screw up. And if you do worse than a C, you know, you just should be thrown out of your job. I'm using C as an average move, like something that I basically would consider chalk, just something anyone would do, not a big deal one way or the other. To me, that's a C. Something less than that is like a move I would not do. or at least not do in this way or at this time or whatever else. Like the Claxton move, if they had waited until, say, July 5th, and they said, all right, we've exhausted the stuff we want to do, now we pull the trigger on this, I would raise it to a C. So a lot of it, to me, was like the practice, not the actual move, but it was the practice of discipline to make the move that I have a problem with. So maybe it probably would call it a C minus if they had waited. I still don't think I would have chased Nick Claxton. A lot of people have pushed back at me and said, well, what would you have done at center? And my answer is like, I don't think I would need to do anything at center. The other last thing I didn't mention yet is his contract goes out 2 years. Everything else they've done only goes out 1 year. And so I don't know that they're going to need more cap space than they have next year. I don't know if they're going to do a lot with it. Cap space is really hard to use in the NBA now compared to in the past. You're not seeing a lot of trades where you can get first round picks by just using cap space like you once did. The shorter contracts have just made that harder. The teams that were in deep apron trouble have largely found ways to get out of it. The ability to take on contracts with the mid-level exception means there's like a lot of optionality that didn't exist before. That was a huge rule change that I don't think people fully understand. It used to be only teams under the cap could kind of like save teams money. But now anyone with a mid-level exception can use that to take a player making less than the mid-level exception back into that mid-level exception. And that means now in a typical year, there's probably 20 teams that can get you salary savings, like straight into cap room and not send money back in a given year. So there's just so much more optionality. When there's more optionality, the value of that transaction goes down. And that's why you're not seeing a bunch of first round picks for that type of move like you did in the past. So I don't know that's a big deal that it goes 2 years, but it does remove some flexibility from the table next year. And again, like I just think for not a great reason. You know, this isn't a year you're going to do a whole lot anyway. So I just don't think it's that important. Some people have countered, well, you need players to not get relegated. That's an interesting debate. I don't know that the relegation really hurts you all that much, especially given how bad the draft is going to be this year coming up and how much better the draft should be in 2 years. And if the Bulls get a top four pick this year, they can't get one in 2 years. You'd rather have it in 2 years. And actually having a kind of like a better floor for your pick, if you get relegated in a bad draft, like knowing you're going to pick, you know, no worse than eighth might be more useful for you than potentially picking in the top four. So I'm not sure the relegation thing matters to me that much. I can see the case where it does. I think it's an interesting nuanced debate. I don't want to spend too much time on it. So that is a lot on Nick Claxton and why overall I think that move just showed a general lack of discipline, maybe some disturbing trends. A lot of that is assumptions. Maybe Splitter didn't weigh in on this and they just like Nick Claxton for other reasons. Maybe they just know a lot more about his personality and how he's going to fit in the locker room and how he's going to help other players develop, and they really value that in a way that I can't see as an outsider. And we'll see how that happens. So the next major move, and I think this one is really big, and maybe the most important move that Bryson Graham made this offseason, is Daylon Swain. And so, famously, on the Big Red Bus, Fred was going to quote me and make fun of me and put it at the front of our intro as me just saying, like, anyone but Daylon Swain was who I wanted to make fun of me. I think after Daylon Swain had a poor summer league, he opted out of that plan because he didn't want to rub it in himself that he loved Daylon Swain. But here's the thing. Any draft pick, I've said this many times, you just never know. There's so much information on these guys available. If you're taking a guy generally in the range, you're hoping that they improve on things as they go forward, that they make leaps that maybe aren't super obvious. I think Daylon Swain was a very, very poor choice for that type of thing. He's a three-year college player. He's very well built out. You know, he's shown kind of steady improvement over his college career, but he's still a very poor shooter. I just think at 21, if you're a very poor shooter, you've had a lot of time to work on it. You're physically mature for your age. I'm just not super excited about you being the type of prospect that's going to make an unlikely leap forward. He was also known as a guy who was like very athletic. But then when you saw the combine results, I think that became a lot more difficult to say. He had a really poor combine experience in terms of his athletic testing. He was very poor. And so a guy who seemed athletic when people were scouting him didn't test that way. Now, sometimes guys play a lot more athletically than they test. And maybe Swain is going to be one of those type of guys. But he looks like, on paper, a very pedestrian NBA athlete, not a plus NBA athlete. And when you try to look at what he did in summer league, that kind of felt that way too. So you've got an older prospect athleticism was maybe overrated on the scouting and not really there as much in reality. He doesn't really have role player skills. If you think of role player skills as being like elite defense and shooting, he doesn't have the shooting. Now, he was a good defender in college and was viewed as a good defender, but as soon as you see that athleticism maybe wasn't as good as you thought it was, that defense maybe is not going to translate so well. And so you look at a guy whose main offensive skill is self-creation, you know, a little bit of questionable handle and questionable on the passing. That's not a guy who's necessarily going to come in and have like a thing they can just put their stamp on right away. And so how well Swain does is going to be largely dictated by how much he improves in shooting. And I think he can become an Okoro type shooter very easily. I think he could become a Pat Williams type shooter very easily. And by that, it's like a guy with a slow release that can hit a wide open three in the corner without a problem at a pretty good percentage. That really isn't that useful for you. I think people very much overstate how valuable 3-point percentage is as a metric. And I used to be one of these people, so I don't blame you. But when I look at it now, the volume is so much more important than the percentage, unless there's just a huge gap in the percentage. Can you get a three off quickly? Can you get a three off with someone in your face? Can you get a three off from multiple spots on the floor? Can you hit a step back three? Can you hit a three off the dribble? Can you, you know, hit a three that you walk into on a fast break? Like, those types of things become way more important than just what your 3-point percentage is when you're getting assisted threes and you're wide open. Those are the things that control how closely someone has to stay to you, because people don't need to stay close to Patrick Williams to defend his 3-point shot. It's slow wind up. You know, they can stay like 8-9 feet off of him and still crowd the paint and still recover on him pretty easily. And so Swain has to be a good shooter, I think, to make this work. And at 21, for a guy who hasn't been a good shooter yet, I just think to develop all of that shot quality is going to be very hard for him. I saw someone use this analogy. It's kind of like, do you want to build a new house, or do you want to knock down an old rotten house first and then build a new house? When you're taking a 21-year-old guy who can't shoot, you're kind of doing the second of those things rather than just building a house from scratch. I think that's actually a little bit harder. In the summer league, this is a guy who I would have expected to play really well. His main skill has been self-creation. And a lot of people said, well, he was playing point guard, and so we should just kind of say this isn't his role. And if he was in his role, he'd be a lot better. And I don't think anyone was really looking for him to display amazing passing vision, but he struggled to bring the ball up the floor, and probably he wouldn't do that in the NBA. And so the ball handling, yeah, definitely needs work. But what really did stand out to me and what concerned me the most is this is a guy whose main skill is self-creation, and that was a lot of what he was asked to do. So ignore the fact that he didn't have this great court vision. Ignore the fact that he kind of struggled to bring up the ball up the floor sometimes. Just focus on the number of possessions he had on the perimeter where he tried to create his own shot, and he ended up shooting like 12% for summer league. It was statistically the worst shooting performance of anyone with 30 attempts in summer league history. And it was about half as good as the second worst guy. Like, the second worst guy ever with 30 attempts was shooting like 20%. He was like 12%. So when people say like, well, other people have been bad, like, no one has been this bad. No one has been close to this bad. Like, this is historically bad. Now, there have been some other guys who have been around this bad, but had, like, say, 20 attempts. So, you know, part of this is a little bit of magic numbers thing to point out. But, I mean, it was in a level of bad that is radically different than other players. I believe one such guy who was similarly bad with a lower number of attempts was George Hill, who actually became a valuable NBA player. So, again, this doesn't preclude him from necessarily becoming a good player. But it was concerning to me that he couldn't do well. It's something I would expect him to be a superpower. I mean, defenses are disorganized in summer league. They're not playing their best defensive ball in summer league. The guys don't know each other. They don't know how to rotate. This is an area where someone trying to create for themselves off the dribble on the perimeter as their superpower, who is physically mature, is 21 years old, has been in college for 3 years, should really excel against this level of competition. And he didn't. And we weren't even playing the best guys of other teams. Like, Darren Peterson sat that game, you know, when we were matched up against him. AJ DeBanza sat the game we were up against him. So, like, a lot of these teams were, like, benching their best guys and saying, we've already seen enough. And we were going up against a second string summer league guys on these teams. And he still struggled. And so, to me, that was a problem. On defense, I didn't see a lot of defensive versatility or strength. That's a lot harder to gauge in a summer league game. You did see like this elite recovery and ability from Caleb Wilson in Summer League. So, you know, that just popped off the page. I definitely did not see that from Swain, you know. And so this is still very early. Still very early for a guy. Like, we got to wait and see what happens. But I think the road is going to be long and difficult and very narrow for Dalen Swain to be a good NBA player. Now, I could be wrong. So part of this is I'm coming in with priors, right? Like, I didn't like Swain when we drafted him. I'm a draft idiot. I spent like 30 minutes scouting Swain. That was my opinion of him coming in. Our guys spent probably 1,000 hours per player that they were looking at, poring over film. And so I will just wait and see. I have an opinion now, but I'll wait and see. I'm not judging this move right now. If I was, I wouldn't like it. If I was right now, at this very exact moment in time, I'd call it an F. But I think it's just way too early to judge it. So I'm leaving it as an incomplete. We'll just see what happens. Concerns early. But I can't say this is a discipline problem or anything else like that. This is Bryson Graham, whose superpower, in theory, is scouting, saying, this is the guy. I believe in him. And you know what? Every time I heard Swain talk, I thought he was amazing. Like, I loved, seemed super mature, seemed like a really good character guy. I can see why you would fall in love with this kid, just interviewing him and talking to him. And there's a human part of this that, again, I'm not seeing. And I think Swain really excels at that human part. And hopefully he gets his confidence up and he works hard and he's got all his great character traits. And that's what allows him to be one of these guys who improves more than you anticipate in ways you don't anticipate. And we'll see if that ends up being true. I wouldn't count it out. You know, that's just one of those things that's always hard to guess. All right. So now we're going to go on to Norm Powell. And so Norm Powell, I think, was the Bulls' best move this offseason. And I thought this one showed a lot of discipline. This one showed really good restraint. You know, we waited. Norm Powell had no other options. He knew he had no other options. We were the only place he was going to go for more money than the mid-level exception. I'm actually a little surprised he signed with us versus finding a better mid-level exception deal. Now, Norm Powell, I don't think is, you know, a fantastic player overall. I know people will say he's an all-star. We should all stop calling him an all-star. He did make the all-star game last year, but he's one of those guys no one legitimately views as like a top 40 player in the NBA, right? Like, no one's looking at Norm Powell as a top 40 player. If they were, he would have gotten way more offers. Now, he got stuck because Miami couldn't sign and trade him because of the aprons and after the Giannis trade. So he was really stuck with, like, I can sign for someone's middle of the exception or I can take this deal with the Bulls. He took the deal with the Bulls. I love the fact that the Bulls got him on a one-year deal with a team option for the second year. I think that was fantastic. That was some really hardcore negotiation to get that deal done, in my opinion. And I think that was good. That showed, like, a lot of patience. They waited till he was out of any other viable choices whatsoever. And then they used all of their leverage to get a good deal. Now, the impact of Norm Powell is a little bit different because, again, it's like a one-year deal for the Bulls, maybe 2 years. He's not going to be on the roster the next time the Bulls make the playoffs, most likely. But I do think this was a nice move in the fact that because of that option, I think there's a very good chance you could maybe move him at the deadline for something. You were able to acquire him in a way that no one else could. You didn't end up paying too much. The optionality makes him very viable for another team that just needs some shooting and needs what he can do, depending on what happens. And they've got a really nice cost control 2-year plan if they need it. They've got an out after 1 year if they want that. I think that's a contract that might have some real flexibility. So nice job there. I give this move a B+. And so, you know, I've kind of got Nick Claxton as a D+. I've got Norm Powell as a B+. Maybe a B. I don't know. The hard thing about going higher than B for me here is simply because the move is so short term. I think he's a good fit for the roster. I think they need a veteran. Everything about this move is good. It's just that I don't know how much real impact it has in the future. So I like everything about the process here. That's all very good, very thoughtful. Well done. So yeah, maybe talked myself into a B. Just the short term nature of it stops me from going B+. We'll walk into Norm Powell now. Norm Powell. I'm just repeating myself. We're going to walk into Zach Collins now. So my first reaction when I saw the Zach Collins news was like, what are we doing here? $9 million for Zach Collins? How is this guy getting more than the vet minimum? But then I stopped to think about it, and I now think this is a little bit interesting. So on the one hand, by taking Collins here, I mean, you're trying to get up to a salary floor, number one, so you can't leave a bunch of cap room open to do something later. You still have your room exception that you can use later. They work this as an exception, so Collins doesn't fit into the room exception exception. So you still have your room exception that you can use later for 9 million. If you want to take on a 9 million player and you have a roster spot left, so you can take a player back. So maybe you can just bail some team out of contracts later if you need for $9 million. And then you have now is a contract that maybe is a good trade asset, you know, just for matching salary. Like you're trying to do something later and you're trying to compose salaries of different sizes or be able to get to different sizes with different players. And that $9 million on Zach Collins is probably more useful than a lower number would be. Like if you need a lower number, you can probably just toss in Leonard Miller really easily. So this high number might actually be better if you're trying to take back a certain amount of salary later and you're trying to aggregate things up. And so I think that's interesting. Also, I noted like Zach Collins prior to last year, it had a pretty consistent amount of playing time. It was a pretty good player and probably more than a $10 million player. I don't think he was going to get this money anywhere else given his injuries and his history. But I do think if he stays healthy, he has a chance to earn this money. And so I think this move is a lot better than it looked on paper. You also have an option on there, probably a stretch to feel like that option is going to get picked up based on how you feel about Zach Collins today. But if he has a healthy season, I think that option has a really good chance of actually being valuable. And again, like say, so Collins has a healthy season, say he plays, you know, all the games or most of the games up to the All-Star break and he plays really well. And now you're like hitting the trade deadline. I think some team might be like, yeah, I will take Zach Collins at this number. And now I've got a good backup center on a good deal for one more year. And maybe there's some optionality there. Again, it's a short-term move. He's a backup caliber player. You are overpaying for this year a little bit, but that overpay makes sense in context. So C plus, we're going to give this one a C plus. Move on to Noah Esenge. And so nothing really happened with Esenge that maybe warrants discussion from a decision-making perspective. But I think this shows like something really interesting in what's going on and raises a flag for me. And so Noah Esenge gets benched in his second summer league game to start the second half. And he says, you know, to the reporters afterwards that Splitter wanted him to play with more force, wanted to play with more energy, more hustle, whatever. But basically that he got benched for his lack of quality play. And I found that to be really disturbing. I find it to be disturbing because Bryson Graham has come out and said, like, you know, our future is Caleb Wilson and Daylon Swain. I think he said that like in the post-draft interview. And so whatever, that makes sense, right, at that point in time. And so maybe he's not really hung up on that so much. But one of these things I think a lot of general managers do when they come in and they take over a team is they assume everything that they inherited was terrible. Everything they did is great. You saw this with Arturas Karnišovas. He came in, he traded Lauri Markkanen, ended up getting nowhere near the value he would have got if he waited. He really hated Kobe White early. They tried to bench him. They tried to move him. Eventually, Kobe White earned a spot to stay against really kind of like the mandate what the front office was trying to do. Same thing with Wendell Carter. They dumped him right away. And that proved out to be fine, not a big problem. But they really just kind of came in and they're like, I'm just going to make over everything that's here. And they didn't value the assets or get the most out of them. I don't see why you bench Esenge in a summer league game and give him this kind of negative feedback. Like there might be some team that was really high on him from last year and is willing to toss you something for him now. Like why would you want to say anything negative to devalue him? Just let him go out and play. I mean, you let Daylon Swain play through literally one of the historically worst summer league performances ever and never benched him. I didn't think Esenge's hustle or energy was bad at all. I actually thought defensively he was putting much more energy and pressure into the game than Swain was. And so what concerns me there is like you are not looking at these guys on an equal level. Now, maybe something happened in practice. Maybe Swain was killing it in practice, was hustling the whole time, and maybe Esenge has a history of dogging it in practice. And one thing happened and you're like, here it goes again with this guy or something. I don't know. Like there's this pieces of this that we cannot see and cannot know. And so that just is what it is. But from what I saw in the games, I thought Esenge was fine. He was trying hard on defense. He was trying to move. Yeah, he's still pretty bad offensively and he couldn't do a whole lot off the dribble or anything else. Just tried to get the ball away from himself. But that might be okay. That might be who he is as a player is not a guy who creates offense for himself. And no one should feel bad about that necessarily, especially at this point. And Asenge is not Pat Williams out here. This isn't season number 7. This is his second season. He is younger than Wilson and younger than Swain. I don't know if he's more sensitive than these guys or if he loves tough treatment or whatever else. Like, I don't know. But he's younger. He should have more rope than these guys, not less rope. And you know what? Caleb Wilson was also like lounging around on defense and uninvolved in lots of plays. He had tons of highlight plays, but if you watch the plays where he wasn't trying to chase down some dude, he often was just kind of floating around, figuring out what to do. And I just think like it was just a weird thing to do. And it makes me concerned that we're not necessarily trying to value all of the assets high or trying to pump up the value of those assets around the league. Now, maybe someone would say, Doug, you're being really dumb here. You just talked about information parity at the start of the show. And now you're going to be like, well, look, I could fool someone by just doing this other thing. No one's going to care what you say or if you bench or anything else. Like, no one's going to care. No one's going to be tricked. The value does not change based on these other comments. Like, it just doesn't matter. And I would say to that, good point. That might be true. But still, it does nothing negative for you to behave in that way. And what you did has some potential to do something negative. And now maybe this is a piece that I just don't know about. But to me, I look at it and I feel like Asenge was singled out in a negative way, in a way other players who are exhibiting similar traits were not. And to me, that is bad in the locker room generally. Now, it could be because of Asenge's other habits or practices or something else that the locker room actually views this as completely appropriate and well-deserved. So that's the piece to me that's just a little bit hard to judge because you're just kind of seeing a very small part of this picture. And the part I'm looking at really makes me think he was treated unfairly, but the whole picture might actually say this was the exact right thing to do. And I don't see it. So that's just kind of like my nuance there, but I rate this as a concern. And when I think about how the Nick Claxton situation played out, where it looks like we kind of had this a little bit like, well, Splitter's got this history with this guy, and so now we're gonna take a chance on him. We think he's better than his recent stuff is. When I see that and when I hear our talks about how we like Swain and how we like Wilson, it makes me more concerned that they just have this kind of pattern of like thinking their shit doesn't stink. And so that's kind of like where I land on that. The final thing I want to talk about, well, maybe the final. I got two more things for you. Selling the second round picks. Now, this is one where I think everyone is universally flaming the Bulls for. And oddly, I've been a little bit more defensive of them around it. It's not that I think it was definitely the best thing to do or anything like that. But I think people have gotten a little bit overzealous in their criticism here. And they've done so based on kind of like these past things that the front office has done. And like, you know, they just feel very emotional about it. And so here's how I just want to lay down the context. I don't think the second round of the draft is as valuable as it used to be. A few things have happened. One, guys are having longer careers. And so with longer careers, the league is turning over less frequently. I mean, at least in the guys who are actually playing, the role players, the guys, and better. Like guys who are playing meaningful minutes, they're turning over less frequently than they were in the past. And that means the more fringe you are as a prospect, the less likely it is you're going to provide value. Two, NIL has changed the math for players coming into the draft. So now, if you're not going to get a guaranteed contract, it often makes way more sense for you financially to go back to school than it ever did in the past. And so I think that is an entirely different thing. There's no longer a race to get out there. So guys who are like good players who could maybe make it in the NBA, but maybe aren't going to make it into the first round guaranteed contract spot, they're more likely to go back and get NIL than they are to say, like, let me take my chances in the second round. I think that's weak in the second round. The third thing is the two-way contract. With the advent of the two-way contract, you now see, at least this is what agents and league stuff has said when I read the reporting, a lot of players are saying to their agent, don't let this team draft me. I don't want to go there. Because I know they're only going to sign me to a two-way contract anyway. And if I just wait till I'm undrafted, I can sign a two-way with whatever team I want. And so a lot of guys are forcing their way to be undrafted so they can sign what they want. Now, if you're willing to sign a guy to a contract in the second round and say, hey, I know I have a roster spot for you and you're talking with the agent, they'll take that. Like, they'll take the guaranteed contract. But if you draft a guy and they say, like, yeah, you're not going to give me that guarantee, I don't want you to draft me. I'd rather just, you know, go fight for a two-way at whatever team I want. It doesn't have to play out that way. Like, you could just draft a guy anyway. But I think the reality is that teams are looking at second rounders and agents and saying, like, do I really want to piss off an agent? Do I really want to bring in a player who doesn't want to be here with my second round pick on a two-way contract? Like, you can do it, and you can force their hand. Like, once you draft them, if you offer them a two-way, they can't take a two-way with someone else. So, you do have leverage, but teams so far, just from what I read, don't seem overly willing to use that leverage. And for those reasons, I just think the second round of the draft just isn't so strong as it used to be. It could be that the guys we signed to two-ways were the guys we would have wanted in the draft anyway, because so many players forced themselves out. It's hard to say. Just hard to say. So, looking at number 38, people have said, well, we just sold this pick for cash. Well, technically, it's not true. We did get a future asset. We got two future second round swaps. Now, were those good assets? No, they're not good assets. But it's something. After us, not a single, I think there was like six or seven other second round picks traded after us. Not a single one of the other ones had a future asset in it. Not a swap, not anything. Every other pick was just like, I will give you a later second round pick and cash. Like, they're all cash transactions. Well, Graham said there wasn't anyone I really wanted on the board left in the second round. So if that's true, getting anything in the future is more useful than getting a later second round pick and cash. So I just don't care that much. Now, if you were to say, hey, Bryson Graham's superpower is supposed to be drafting, why didn't he see someone on the board? Like, that's a crazy statement to make, right? Like, you're basically saying, I think the whole field is bad. Like, you're almost certainly going to be wrong about that, right? There will almost certainly be someone good in the second round. But I think it's fair to say, look, out of the 40 guys who maybe you could have considered at that pick, you just didn't have a strong feeling about any of them. Like, you know, probably three or four of them are going to pan out, but you don't know which one it is. And you don't have a strong feeling about it. And you don't really have a lot of roster spots left. And you already have a ton of young guys in your team. I think it's just kind of fine to say, like, yep, I'm just not excited about anything here. I don't maybe want to take a player who doesn't want to be here. I don't really have a guy I'm going to guarantee a roster spot to. So I'm just going to just move on from this pick. I got a little bit of something for later in the future. Even if it's small, it's like more than anyone else could get. I think that's fine. And the fact that no other team traded into the second round with something from the future, it kind of shows that the league as a whole agreed with Graham that this wasn't a great second round draft for whatever reason. This year wasn't great. Maybe it was so top heavy that guys were just like, I'm going to be a way higher pick next year. And a lot of guys went back to school. They're like, the draft sucks next year. I'll be a way better pick next year. So the guys that maybe would have had depth just didn't go into the draft this year. I think that's totally reasonable that kind of thing played out that way. And you kind of have this backing of the league that it looked that way. And so for this, I think a lot of people are really upset about it. And I'm just kind of like, I don't care. Feels like a totally neutral thing to me. So, I mean, it's hard to give that better than a C as a move, selling future second round picks. But I think I'm like only going to go C minus on that. So, if I'm kind of grading all of the things we did, I'm probably roughly at a C. You know, I think the Norm Powell move was good. The Claxton move was bad. The Swain move, I think, is going to be bad, but I don't score it right now. I give it an incomplete. The way they're treating Asenge, I think, is slightly bad. I think the Collins move, about average, maybe slightly better than above average, because I think it gives you some sneaky flexibility. The second round pick thing, to me, is a throwaway. Maybe I'd give it a C minus. Overall, I think I'm at like C minus for Bryson Graham's offseason. Caleb Wilson makes the offseason an A for the Bulls. Like, these are two separate things. Caleb Wilson makes this offseason an A for the Bulls, like, automatically. Like, it, call it dumb luck, call it whatever, call it Arturis Karnaschovas' last gift. And if you want to believe the article that was written before, you can call it John Paxson's last gift, because John Paxson theoretically demanded that they trade Kobe and Io and go down this rebuilding process that caused the tank, that did whatever against Arturis Karnaschovas' will. And so I don't know if that's true or not. Like, it, the crazy amount of guesswork people do to try to say who says what or whatnot is insane. But that was actually reported, that John Paxson was the one that forced them to make that move. So I'm kind of like somewhere CDC minus. I want to talk about some things maybe we could have done but didn't do. So you've got Duren, probably wants a max contract, probably would have had to give up multiple first-round picks to get Detroit to do a sign-and-trade with you. Maybe you could have just thrown an offer sheet out there if you hadn't taken Nick Claxton, and you could have just made an offer sheet and then forced Detroit's hand to either match or not match. I think Detroit probably matches that. You could maybe argue it was worth even just forcing them to match it just to put Detroit in a worse position, like, in the future. But I'm never a fan of just trying to screw over another team. You know, there's 29 other teams in the league. If you're using your resources to hurt one team rather than to help yourself, I just think that's probably a bad process. Kessler, the trade, I think that was terrible what the Lakers did there. I would not have wanted to get in on that for the total dollars or the assets given up. Peyton Watson, I'm up and down on it. It's hard to say because we don't know how that's ultimately going to resolve. I'm fine passing on it because I think ultimately Denver probably finds a way to match on Watson if you offer him a contract. We don't really know what type of contract Watson was, you know, willing to take if we had made him an offer. But I think that's one that would have been interesting because he's an intriguing fit. That said, he's one of these guys who kind of had like flashes of really good play, but the overall numbers really don't look all that great. And you could easily see where that's a guy you give a lot of money to and then just ends up being a bad contract. So I was not like overly excited to get in on that. If I thought you could do it reasonably, I wouldn't have been upset with it. But I think because of the restricted status, getting a reasonable deal there probably would have been pretty difficult. The few things that I think would have been interesting, you effectively could have traded seconds for Andrew Wiggins. You could have traded seconds for Isaiah Joe. You could have traded seconds for Lu Dort. You could have maybe gotten Zachary Richier in. Those are the moves that I think would have been interesting. I'm not sure if we could have been able to find a way to trade up for Cameron Carr. I think that would have been really interesting if we had found a way to do that. I really liked him a lot in the draft, and he was ultimately moved. But I think the Lakers gave up pick 25 plus something to move up one slot to get him. So those are other moves. But when you look at like all of those different options, I can't say like, wow, if only we had done this. Like maybe some of those moves would have been fine. But I'm not sure any of those other guys would have been guys who would have been here for a long period of time. Taking a chance on Richier probably would have been the one that maybe you say, hey, this is some upside if you want to draft some other guys, you know, past first round pick. I mean, number one overall, you know, definitely flashed something, but played poorly enough that Atlanta was willing to give up on him immediately. Graham, having been in Atlanta last year, probably has a lot of thoughts about him and, you know, probably would have said like, yeah, I'm either in or out on that, like immediately, just knows a lot about him as a person. And so I will trust that, you know, he was not excited about that move. And if so, yeah, probably knows enough to have a better decision than we would on it. Now, maybe he just didn't know that move was going to be available and he would have been excited about it if it was, because by the time that move was made, we no longer had the option to get in on it. So a little bit of wiggle room there. That's one of those things where possibly waiting might have helped us, but it did kind of go so late that probably we would not have waited that long. But we'll just trust they know enough there. So that is my overall super in-depth nuanced look at this offseason. And so, like I said, for me, I give Graham kind of like a C-. There's some red flags that I have. I discussed those in pretty good depth. But a C- isn't a disaster. Like, people will read it as a disaster. Like, how could you be so terrible? I mean, there's 30 guys in the league. It's really hard to outperform the 30 best people in the world, or 29, I guess, other best people in the world or something. Like, so it's just kind of like mostly a holding pattern. Most of the stuff he did was maintain optionality for next year He didn't make any like shockingly bad moves. Potentially Swain becomes that shockingly bad move, but I agree. We're not going to judge that for 3 years. 3 years from now, if Swain is a bust and Cameron Carr is a stud, then this offseason is neff for me. But I won't know that for 3 years. And I, at this point in time, despite Summer League, despite whatever else, I'm going to treat these guys as equal. There's like other guys I like more than Swain too. But yeah, Swain might be the best guy. Like, ignore all the other stuff I said. There's red flags I have, but high character guy. If he works hard and does well, he might be the best guy. Like, there's no reason to jump to conclusions. So right now I give it like a C minus-ish, but, you know, kept flexibility. Maybe I should give him a little more credit simply for not doing anything bad. Maybe that deserves a little bit more credit. But yeah, for a guy making millions of dollars, that's just not enough for me to give anyone credit for, whether it's him or anyone else. Like, I just don't give anyone credit for just not doing dumb things. There's a couple guys like that. You know, Joe Dumars is a guy maybe who actively does bad things. Like, that guy should not have a job. But outside of that, I just would not give people credit just for avoiding a mistake. I give you credit for making really creative, good moves. So we'll see what happens with Graham going forward. And also, just to note, it's his first year and his first job of this level. There's a lot to learn. People get better at what they do. You know, this is not like, oh no, Bryson Graham is just terrible. Like, sometimes I think it comes off that I feel that way. But no, I mean, it's his first year on his first job. And, you know, I've had a lot of different promotions in my life. I didn't knock out the first year of all of them out of the park either. Like, it just took some time to really like find my way in different things. And I think anyone who's kind of gone through a career progression finds that. Like, you get better as time goes on. So hopefully we see that out of Bryson as well. Anyway, that will do it for this solo edition of the Big Red Bus. And hopefully Fred and I will talk to you sometime soon.